Good, so welcome back everyone, and welcome to people. I know a few people have just arrived in the tea break, so a very warm welcome. So as I was saying, tonight we're going to be carrying on with exploring this theme of Dharmic receptivity, which is the theme of our seminar. Actually, it's the theme of our whole year here at the LBC, so you'll probably be hearing quite a lot about it. So each week of this seminar, we've been exploring different aspects of Dharmic receptivity. So let's see if I can remember them all. So we had receptivity to Vedana, that was the kind of primary one. You can watch these, they've all been recorded and videoed. And then we had receptivity in relation to art and nature. And then last week, Maitreya Banerjee started us off on talking about receptivity to other people, particularly spiritual friends, and particularly people who are wiser than ourselves. And we thought, well, there's such a big, there's such a lot in that, we thought we'd have 2 weeks on that. I'm hoping there'll be a chance for some discussion on this as well tonight. Sometimes we just talk as we want to do, and sometimes we leave a space for you to talk. So I'm hoping to leave some space for you to be able to talk as well. And yeah, so I'm going to just further explore this theme, and I'm going to partly be using, it's a little booklet, it's one of my favourites actually. It's this one, it's called Discipleship and the Western Buddhist Order. The Western Buddhist Order is what Tree Ratna used to be called. And this is a transcript of a talk given in 1995, but it's so fresh still. It's one of my favourite talks. I've heard so many talks over the years, but this one sticks out in my mind. It was given on an order event, and it was given the very year I was ordained, about 2 or 3 weeks after I was ordained. And so vivid to me still, and I remember both the talk and the effect of the talk. I remember grown men being reduced to tears by this talk when they heard it. So I really would recommend, if you can get it, you can send away for it and get it from Padmaloka Books, or it's often to be found at our retreat centres. So I'm going to be using it. It's by Ratna Guna, as some of you might know. He's the author of that book on reflection. He's visited this centre a couple of times. So I'm going to be referring to that, which I find inspiring. So we were last week talking particularly about receptivity to people who are wiser than ourselves. Maitreya Banerjee said this was the sort of vertical aspect of friendship, of dharmic friendship, is receptivity to people that are wiser than ourselves. So it's quite a kind of interesting, even fraught subject, this, you know, because there's a kind of inherent tensions in it, and that's what I want to explore tonight. And I want to start off by talking about this word, which I've written up on a makeshift flip chart here, apatrapia. And I just wondered if anyone knows what that word means. That is not heedfulness. It's a little bit like apramado sound to that, but yeah, that's not heedfulness.
Fear of censure from the wise.
Fear of censure from the wise. Okay, let's write that up. Fear of censure from the wise. let's see if there's any other translations of it.
Fear of being trapped.
Fear of being trapped. Well, that might be a sort of a. We'll come back to that. That's a good response from that translation. But let's stick to what the translation of the word is. We'll come back to this fear of being trapped.
Should I write that down? The fear of being trapped.
Maybe write that on another. We'll save that. We'll write it on another page. Because we definitely will come back to it. Yeah, put it in a little corner or something to remember. Any other translations of apatrapia? Look, some of you should know this. I know some of you know.
I've heard it translated as a sense of shame based on your respect for others.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not fear, but it's shame. Almost embarrassment.
Embarrassment, okay.
Because of your respect for
others. Yeah, of your respect for others. So let's...
Positive shame?
Positive shame, yeah. Positive shame and... yeah.
Painful but positive.
Yeah. Painful, positive. That's good to bring that out.
Isn't it also fear of being censored by others?
Okay, so we've got that one, haven't we? Fear of being, fear of censor by the wise, yeah. So, and then Lokabandha said this respect. So, a simple way to put it, following on from Lokabandha, is respect for wise opinion. So you could put that up as well. I'm not saying that what Todd said was wrong either. We're going to come back to that. There's different ways of translating these words. So, I'm going to be exploring this even more next week. This idea of positive shame, for example. So it's definitely this word. Respect for wise opinion, apatrapia, is usually used when we're talking about Buddhist ethics. So it's usually used when we're talking about our ethical behaviour in the sense of positive shame that we might feel. And as I say, we'll be revisiting that next week. But I'm quite relating to this sort of broader sense of the word, just a more general sense of respect for wise opinion. I was in a study group the other week over at Karuna. Kevin was there actually, weren't you, Kevin? And we talked about this word, and somebody said that in its broadest sense, you could think of it in a way of being open to influence. Yeah, that this word can mean the sort of spirit of apatrapia, of the spirit of the respect for wise opinion, is the spirit of being open to influence. And when we talked about it in the study group, the person that kind of described it in that way, he said that what he'd been thinking was that that's what makes the whole spiritual life possible, is an ability to be open to influence. He says that's why he'd been thinking about, well, why does it work for some people and not for others, say, who maybe get involved in the Buddhist centre or come along? And there's a sort of sense of, for it to work, you have to be open to influence, yeah? We heard last week, Maitreya Banda was telling us about the story of how the very first person that met the Buddha actually wasn't open to the Buddha's influence. So in a way, you can have all the Buddhas you like in the room or walking down the street, but if you're not open to their influence, it's not going to affect you. There has to be something from your end. But you can probably immediately see, at least I hope you can anyway, of how this is immediately a bit fraught, yeah? This open to influence. And that's what I want to explore. And that's where we can come back to this fear of being trapped. So if we could have a new page, Sal, please. Thanks for doing this, Sal. And what I want to... So on one hand, we've got somebody saying, well, that you need this spirit of being open to influence for the spirit of life, the spirit of the Dharma life to work. But there's immediately kind of dangers, as I imagine you can see. Anyway, I hope you can see. So I thought we could start off with, well, what are the dangers of being open to influence? What could go wrong if you're open to influence? Yes.
You could be open to influence by people you think are wise but actually aren't.
Yes, okay. And what would happen then?
It would be a bad influence.
Yeah, yeah, it would be a bad influence. Yeah, brilliant, okay. Yeah.
They might want to take advantage of you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they might not just want to, they might
be exploited in some way.
Be exploited in some way, yeah.
And maybe like be irresponsibilized, or like just not making.
Ah, yes, you lose your own sense of responsibility. Is that what you meant?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You could be manipulated.
Yeah, you could be manipulated.
They could let you down.
Yeah. Probably will, yeah.
Could lead you further from the truth.
Yeah, they could lead you further from the truth. That's the sort of tie them with the bad influence, possibly. Yes.
Maybe it avoids oneself thinking or having to become critical. Maybe seeing, learning things from experience or being actually in a way too. But maybe being too open might mean that we're not making enough effort also to discover things.
Stops you thinking from yourself. Yes.
Even if it's a good influence, I think there's the fear of the ego kind of holding on to its ideas and thinking what you think is right or not.
If
it's a good influence, you might be afraid of losing perspective.
Yeah, so would it summarise that to say you could become rather passive, or rather, is that enough, or just trying to...
It's like creating all these ideas that you set in your ways, and then if you're influenced, you have to let a little of that go.
Sort of clinging to the idea of, what do you mean?
I'm just trying to say, could you summarise that in a few words, just so we can put it up?
What could?
The fear of losing your idea of yourself.
Could use it some.
Okay. Yeah, so what have we got that down to quite here?
Fear of losing your identity.
Yes.
Somehow if someone's got an idea that's mistaken, and you're being influenced by them, then you don't have the opportunity to correct them either. Sometimes people need to be told they're wrong. If you let yourself always be influenced, then you deny them the rights.
So how are we going to summarise that? It sort of denies a mutuality, would that be?
Well, you might just get your feelings really hurt.
You might get your feelings really hurt, yeah.
You could then also influence other people.
So you could perpetuate.
What was that one?
You could sort of perpetuate sort of wrong ideas.
What you think is true.
Alibism. Alibism, like you sort of sense that it's wrong, but you want to go for it anyway, and then pretend in front of yourself that you thought that it's actually right choice. But it was wrong. So, sort of, you feel you've got a sense that it's a bad influence, but you go for it anyway, and then you sort of blame the other person.
I see. So, sort of projection, sort of negative projection, maybe, or I think I know what you mean. I'm just trying to summarise it.
Displacement of responsibility.
Is that?
You could become let down and just get cynical. You go to the opposite. And that becomes fixed.
It could cause disharmony within your own circle, whether it's your family or your community. It might cause some kind of disharmony because people can see that you're being influenced.
Disharmony. Yeah, okay, so one more. I know there's probably hundreds, but we're going to have one more, but that's from Brian.
I'd just be concerned about the amount of time I'd waste.
That's a really good one,
Find the right route. We'll go back to the beginning and try and find
the right
answer.
Waste of time, good.
So I'd rather just procrastinate and waste time.
So that's great. And so sorry to cut you off on your prime as well. So basically, you can see there's quite sort of... this is interesting, isn't it? Because there's a lot of dangers of being open to influence, and I'm sure we could go on and on, but hopefully the evening will sort of cover them implicitly. I would like a new page now, And I'd like you to see, tell me the dangers of not being open to influence.
Ignorance.
Okay.
Narrow-mindedness.
What's that?
Narrow-mindedness,
yeah. What was yours, Todd?
It was ignorance, but it was, you'll never learn anything new.
Okay, never learn, okay.
You could waste your entire life.
You could?
Waste your entire life.
Waste your entire life? Okay, how would you waste your entire life, though?
Because you're not able to make any sort of progress.
Okay, yeah, so not able to make progress, waste your entire life.
Stuckness.
Stuck in thought. And not being able to be receptive.
Okay, yeah.
Loneliness.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Inability to adapt.
Yeah, yeah.
Arrogance.
Yes, yeah.
You have to start your own religion.
Yeah.
Isn't everybody influenced by somebody? Like, what do you mean by influence? Because you can't really not be influenced by people, can you?
No, well, that's true in a way, so we could put that down, that you can't really, I think that's a good point, isn't it? That you can't really not be influenced, but you can, well, you can try not to be. So maybe a better way of phrasing it, what's the dangers of kind of trying not to be open to influence? You can certainly make good efforts to try not to be, can't you? But I think, yeah, that's fair enough, we're always influenced.
It's sort of like a denial of what's actually going on around you if you think you're not influenced by people.
I think that is a good point. We are always influenced from somewhere or another.
Exhaustion or fatigue because you put so much, people put effort into denying influence. To go against things that could influence them, to stick in their position.
Yeah.
They become fatigued because of it.
Yeah, comforting. So that's in a way it follows on from what Kenyatta said.
I think you can live in fear as well. If you're not open to a lot of things.
Oh.
Become quite cynical, like living in fear.
Yeah, okay.
A bit closed off.
That's
the more closed off you get, the more fearful you get.
Okay, very interesting. Apparently. Yes.
And we might get stuck in our own ways also.
Yeah.
Just staying stuck in the same kind of behaviour.
So stuck in your own ways.
Missed opportunities.
Missed opportunities.
Might not have any friends.
And that ties in with the loneliness, someone said, didn't they?
I think diminished experience.
Diminished experience, yeah. Can you say more? I can't actually see who said that, but...
Caroline.
Oh, Caroline, diminished experience, can you... What's that?
I just think it's a... You lose a sense of expansiveness.
Okay.
It's similar to arrogance, but the ego just becomes too important.
Yeah. Okay, so your own ego sense becomes the most important thing. That's a good one to have that just spelled out.
It just ties in with the loneliness, but I guess it's the obvious one is just unhappiness. But
okay, unhappiness.
They cling on to what they know to give them stability.
Yeah.
And then they think the stability kind of can create happiness, but then if you get stale, you just cling on to what you know, and then it can become quite unhappy.
Better make that's the last one.
I'm trying to think of the best way to say it. Maybe you can say it better, but it would might tend towards too much self-absorption.
That's a very good way of saying it. Yeah, tend towards too much self-absorption. Okay, and again, I think as we spark each other off, we could probably go on. Well, we've got ourselves a nice little problem here, haven't we? Because we've got a whole page of dangers of being open to influence, and then we've got another whole page of dangers of not being open to influence. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? So what are we going to do? So I hope that with the help of Rant and Gunnar in this little 12 pages I'm clutching, we can kind of find our way through this. And also, well, it's not just with the help of Rant and Gunnar. The Buddha himself has talked about this, luckily. And Bhante's talked about it as well. So we've got our tension, you know, we've got a dilemma. And in his lecture, Ratnaguna says that this is what the spiritual life actually thrives on. In a way, they're quite interested in these tensions because they make us have to, in the very grappling with them, that's what can make our Dharma life come alive in a way. And yeah, so the tension, it seems to be, it's kind of between the tensions between, you could say, the individual in isolation, as we've really seen here, you know, this kind of doing it all for yourself and so on, and then the individual in relation to others, especially those who we might say are wiser than ourselves. The distinction between thinking for ourselves, as has been drawn out, and then listening to people who are teachers or who are, yeah, more experienced than ourselves, the sort of tension between self-reliance, you could say, and other reliance. And Ramaguna calls this a potentially creative tension, and he's very careful to have this word potentially, that it can be a creative tension, but it also could not, you know, it could be quite a destructive tension. So how can we make this a creative tension? So I'm going to tell you a couple of stories from the time of the Buddha that I think kind of, well, for me, they help to draw this out more. So, and I think they draw out the essential qualities we need to find our way through this, you know, this what seems like, what seems a bit insoluble if you just look at it. There's a danger of doing it, there's a danger of not doing it. What qualities we need to find our way through. So the stories are of a couple of encounters with the Buddha. So the first encounter with the Buddha was by a man called Nigrodha, who was a wanderer, and he was a leader of his own sect. And all he wanted to do, basically, was argue with the Buddha. Like, he was dying to meet the Buddha, but he really wanted to meet the Buddha because he wanted to argue with him, and he thought he could beat the Buddha in an argument. It says he used to boast that if he met the Buddha, he would baffle him with a single question and knock him over like an empty pot. So you can kind of probably see what's coming. He does meet the Buddha in front of his whole 500 followers, his own 500, Nigrodha's 500 followers. And one of his followers said, "Oh, Nigrodha, like, there's the Buddha. You said you could knock him over like an empty pot. On you go then," sort of thing. And of course, he doesn't. He can't do it. He cannot defeat the Buddha in argument. And he ends up his shoulders drooping, and hung his head downcast and bewildered. So that's the first encounter. But you've got this interesting character who wants to meet the Buddha, but only because he wants to argue with the Buddha. And then you've got a contrasting figure, and the contrasting figure is called Arita. And Arita is a disciple of the Buddha. He's a bhikkhu. And he has learned the Buddha's teaching, but he hasn't learned it right, really. And what he's been doing, but he's then been teaching it. So this is interesting because it ties in with what somebody said about you can learn the teachings wrong and then teach them to others, which is exactly what he's doing, Arita. And the Buddha is not very pleased with Arita. And what he says is, look, he says, what you've done, Arita, is you haven't really thought about this. You haven't thought about my teaching properly. He says, you've thought it was good enough to learn it off by heart, but not test it by means of intuitive wisdom. So that's quite interesting, isn't it? That's what he's done. He's kind of probably thinking he's doing the right thing. He's going, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll be a good disciple. I'll learn it all off by heart, and then I'll be fine. And then the Buddha will think I'm great, and I can teach all these people. The Buddha doesn't think it's great. He says, learn it off by heart. No, no, that's not what I want you to do. I want you to think about it and test it with your intuitive wisdom. And the Buddha goes on to say, says, those things whose meanings are not tested by intuitive wisdom do not become clear. Yeah, so that you've got this interest in this interest and contrast of these two. You've got one who just wants to argue, so you could say that's a strong individualist response, but then one who just wants to kind of take it all on board without thinking about it. And neither of these are good disciples of the Buddha. Well, Nagroda isn't a disciple at all, but even Arata, who thinks he's a disciple, isn't a good disciple. And you've kind of got the opposite quality. So you could say, and this is what Ratnaguna draws out, he says that he thinks that Arata was sincere, but he wasn't very intelligent. Not, and when he uses intelligent, it doesn't mean in the sense of, you know, intellectual knowledge. He hadn't tested them in his experience, yeah? He hadn't used his own intelligence. And Nagroda wasn't the Buddha's disciple and didn't want to be. But he did seem most intelligent. The Buddha even says elsewhere that you're an intelligent man. But he wasn't sincere. He just wanted to get the better of the Buddha. If he could have, he wanted to make the Buddha look foolish. I mean, he couldn't do that, but that's what he wanted to do. So he wasn't sincere. So both of them kind of came to grief. One had the sincerity but not the intelligence. The other had the intelligence but not the sincerity. So you could draw out from this that what you need is both these qualities. If you're going to have the really have apatrap here, if you're going to really be able to have this openness to influence and to wise opinion but not kind of come a cropper, you're going to need to have both sincerity and intelligence. You're going to have to watch for erring towards more one than the other. We probably all err towards more one than the other, or probably at different times we err towards one more than the other. So, but you need the both of these. And I really like that the Buddha draws out, I particularly like that the Buddha draws out this quality of intelligence. The Buddha kind of wants to meet people who use their intelligence. He says, he actually says to Nagroda, the first one, he says, I tell you this, let an intelligent man come to me who is sincere, honest and straightforward, and I will teach him Dharma. And I've often thought about that. I really like it that the Buddha wants people who are intelligent. The Buddha isn't saying, oh, let me have a few gullible people and I'll convert them all. You know, he actually wants you to come and like use your intelligence. He doesn't want you to be gullible. I think that's very, very clear in the story of the one who just learns the teachings off by heart. The Buddha wants us to have both. So you could say that these are the two essential qualities. And as we probably kind of veer towards either one or the other, or kind of more often we just ricochet from one to the other. We're too gullible, you know, and then we kind of go, right, I'll never be fooled again, you know, and you kind of batten down the hatches, or maybe you do some sort of slighter version of that. What we need to do is find a middle way, and as we've said before in this seminar and before, the middle way in Buddhism isn't just a halfway, so it's not like you've got kind of gullibility here and kind of cynicism here, and the middle way is just halfway in between, that you're kind of a bit of both, you know, and they meet in the middle. The middle way is somewhere completely over and above both. You're trying to find a resolution that goes over and above both, and I think that's what we've been calling like proper dharmic receptivity, responsiveness. Or this combination, as I'm saying tonight, of this intelligence and sincerity, both. So what we're trying to do is we're treading that middle way between the extremes of authority on the one hand, in the sense where you just look up to authority. I think, like someone says, you just want to be told what to do. You sort of abnegate your own thinking power on one hand, and individualism on the other, where you think, all right, I'm just going to, nobody's going to tell me what to do. Yeah, so you're trying to find something over and above both. Or else, yeah, you fall into all these dangers, you know. So there's another little story, also cited by Ratnaguna. He's very good on finding these things in the Pali Canon. That I, again, from the time of the Buddha, that again, more kind of, more in an image, sort of illustrates these qualities. And it's a story that the Buddha's said himself. So the Buddha tells a disciple called Badali, he says this, he says, suppose that I asked an arahant, so an arahant's somebody that's also enlightened, to make a causeway of himself across the mud, so to lie down in the mud so that I could walk across him. Would he do it? Or would he do it but writhing his body around like a snake in other directions? Or would he just not do it? Yeah? So Badali answers, he says, I don't know actually if Badali says all this, but anyway, we could extrapolate from this. So it's interesting, we've got these three options. You've got either just doing it, just lying down in the mud so the Buddha can walk over you, lying down but kind of squirming around, you know, the Buddha, you know, or else just go, no way, I'm not doing it, right? So somebody who's not a disciple of the Buddha just wouldn't do it, right? You just... You know, somebody who wasn't just would say, "No, I'm not doing it." Yeah, would just refuse outright. Somebody who was a disciple but who wasn't enlightened, or maybe wasn't very far along the path, but was quite devoted to the Buddha, but you know, hadn't reached enlightenment or hadn't reached what we call stream entry. He would do it, or she would do it. But they would kind of writhe around and twist their bodies around doing it. And if you think what that means, well, what do you think that means, like lying down but sort of twisting around? What does that image say?
Not committed.
Yeah, not committed, yeah. There's sort of conflict. You're sort of doing it, but you don't really fully want to do it, yeah? You're doing it with conflict. You kind of, a bit of you think, oh, I really want to lay myself down for the Buddha, but another bit of you is going, oh, like this mud's horrible and it's just so degrading and what people think of me and am I being taken in, am I being... So all sorts of doubts arise in your mind and that will make you sort of twist around. So you've got both these feelings, you've got all the feelings of love and gratitude and respect, they're all prompting you to do it, but then, yeah, all this kind of, your egotism, your pride, your more selfish feelings will say no, yeah? And I imagine that's probably the position that most of us are in. You know, we can translate this lying down in the mud just to ordinary things that we might, you know, a bit of us wants to do it, a bit of us doesn't, you know. I just think how to give examples from my own life. it's almost nerve-wracking. I was just thinking today, actually, I think... So today I was just sort of going around my business and then, you know, very happy to be teaching tonight because, you know, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. You know, in a way I'm set up to do this. But then suddenly at the last minute I was called on to teach the lunchtime class as well and I was like, oh, that wasn't my job to teach the lunchtime meditation. So this bit of me is kind of going, oh no, I don't want it. And then I say, oh, but people have come to learn the Dharma, you know, so... You know, I was writhing around like that in the mud. You know, and I did it, and I really enjoyed it. I think some of you are even here. I really, once I did it, you know, you feel it's often that way as well, isn't it, once you actually do it. But there was definitely that wriggling. There was, I wonder if I could get out of it, you know. It's because it's just an idea in my mind, you know. It was something about, oh yeah, teaching tonight is kind of what I'm supposed to do. It's funny that, isn't it? But it's teaching the lunchtime. No, that's not my bit of thought, you know, it's very compartmentalised, whereas if you were able to think broader, you'd just see, well, it's all the same thing, really. But yeah, there I was, twisting around in the mud, but I hastened to add, thoroughly enjoying it once I was there. So yeah, so that is the position. People sort of relate to that, that twist, yeah, that twist around in the mud. So, and in a way that is interesting, because that is this creative tension that we have, gives us something to work with. Well, it's just quite interesting to notice, well, why am I twisting around in the mud here? What if I were just to do it, you know? Or not do it, actually. You're probably better doing something or not doing it, I always think, than that sort of twisting around. But then it's interesting what an arahant would do. So an arahant, another enlightened being, we're told, would simply do it. Another enlightened being would simply lay down their body in the mud for the Buddha to walk over. So it's interesting to say, why would they do that? And Bhante himself, he was talking about this incident. He said, well, Bhante says there's two possibilities. So he says, first of all, it can be out of pure devotion for the Buddha. So an arahant would, even though enlightened, would still see the Buddha as their teacher, because the Buddha was the first one. So that would be out of devotion. And secondly, now this is interesting, as an example of obedience. But interesting enough, it's just an example of obedience, because an arahant is not obedient to the Buddha. But that's not because an arahant is disobedient to the Buddha. It's that an arahant, another enlightened being, has completely gone beyond those categories of obedient or disobedient. So that an arahant would have no egotistical tendencies at all. The arahant, he or she, would be in perfect harmony with the Buddha. So there'd be no conflict and there'd be no question of obedience. Do you see what I mean? But that means it's not disobedient. It's just that just doesn't come into it. And I think I get really interested in that. Ranaguna says, he draws it out a bit more in a really interesting way. He says, as you grow spiritually, he says, you get less and less obedient. So I really like that. But that doesn't mean disobedient. It's the same thing. It's, yes, because this concept of obedience gets less and less relevant. But that's because you become more and more like your teacher. That's because you become more and more like the Buddha. So you're more and more attuned to their mind. So you've not got that question anymore. So it's just, you would just tune in with what your teacher told you to. And again, you might have had experience of this even, you know, or even just an ordinary friendship. I think we've talked about it in the class before. If somebody you really love asks you to do something, you're happy to do it. There's no sense in you're kind of thinking, oh, I'm being obedient to them. You just want to do it. Sometimes we even say that to our friends, you know, oh, is there anything I can do to help you? And that one they say, oh, yes, well, there is actually. You think, oh, great, I can help them. And then if it's somebody you look up to, even though they've kind of asked you what to do, it's like a kind of bit of a transformation happens, but it's quite, or I don't want this to sound too kind of too grandiose, because it just feels quite ordinary. At the time I had this myself, and just after I wrote this book that I've written, I was kind of encouraged to go on this tour of different Buddhist centres to promote the book, and I was kind of thinking, oh God, I'm not sure if I really want to do that, like, you know, trek all the way here and there just to, you know, sell a few books, you know. My rational mind said, oh, I'd be better staying here where there's loads of people, and then just, you know, talking about it here. So rationally, I thought, it doesn't really make sense, like, trekking off to Sheffield and Glasgow and da-da-da, and it'll be really tiring, and, you know, the train fare will cost the number of books that I'll sell, you know. It doesn't make sense. And then I'd happened to, always a dangerous thing to do, write a little note to Sankaracharya to say, oh, my book's out now, you know. And he immediately, within like less than 24 hours later, email came back, I'm very pleased your book, Not About Being Good, has now been published. I hope there will be a tour of centres with a talk at each centre. And I thought, oh, right. Apparently, I think I was writhing around in the mud a little bit. There was a bit of like, oh no, you know, I have to do it. But also there was a new understanding. I thought, oh yes, of course, of course. It's not about how many books I sell. It's like Bhante wants talks on ethics to go around centres. That must be, if you're Bhante, you must think, oh good, someone's written a book on ethics. That's a good subject. It's probably not talked about enough. Oh, that's good, you know. It's good if somebody goes around saying, so I got on, it's like suddenly I kind of was in the mind of Bhante a bit. So it wasn't me just kind of thinking, oh God, I better do it now because Bhante said it. Maybe a little bit, you know. But there was, it was much more like suddenly I got a new perspective. So my mind was a bit more tuned into, oh yeah, why has he responded so quickly to this? And obviously, you know, this must really matter to him, and he really wants me to do it. So I better take this seriously. And oh yeah, actually I see what he means. And then it was easy to do. So it's that kind of so then it didn't feel like I'm being obedient and I'm being a good person, you know, a good girl doing what Bhante said. It's like now I've got more perspective. So I think this is what we're trying to do. Yeah, this is the, when we talk about being receptive to people wiser than ourselves, it's that kind of quality. There's got to have, yeah, I keep sort of saying this, both the sincerity and intelligence in it. And it's, I think, I'm hoping that we might have touched on this in the, when I got you to think about, you know, the person who first taught you to meditate or the person who first taught you the Dharma. That there's something, that it's a living thing. You all seemed like you were talking in quite a lively way. So I'm hoping what that meant is that you felt that connection in quite a live way. I know for me that there's a very strong gratitude involved and a sort of heart, there's something heartfelt about it. When I think of the person who taught me to meditate, there's something, it's interesting actually, it's something heartfelt that in a way goes beyond, it is completely to do with the actual person, and it goes beyond the actual person as well. I mean, it was interesting for me because the person who did teach me to meditate, if I may say so, I'm very slightly annoyed with him at the moment over something. If he's listening, I'm sure he won't mind me saying that. I'm very slightly annoyed with him at the moment. And I thought, I'm a bit annoyed with you. I don't know if I want to think of it. But as soon as I thought of him like teaching me to meditate and thought my whole life would be completely, unimaginably the poorer, you know. I mean, it just, this little, it was like the annoyance was about this size, and the amount of sort of gratitude was about like 100 miles. Do you know what I mean? There's no kind of comparison. It's not that, you know, it's not that there isn't this little bit of annoyance, but there's no comparison. So almost there's this sort of human interaction, but there's something that goes beyond that as well. I hope I'm managing to say that clearly, because it's not that they're not a human being. In a way, it's very important to regard them as that. But there's something, I think there's something about that. There's something about that gratitude that's involved. That, well, maybe goes beyond the kind of what we normally think of as kind of human interaction with all this kind of petty little, you did this, you did that. I think this is illustrated in the Pali Canon as well. Lovely, my favourite story really. You've got this story of Ashvajit and Shariputra. And so you've got Ashvajit as this person who's kind of wandering around trying to find the truth. Is it this way around? No, it's the other way around. Shariputra is this person who's wandering around trying to find the truth. And he comes across Ashvajit. Now, Ashvajit is already a disciple of the Buddha's. And Shariputra comes across Ashvajit and can see by the look of him that he looks like he's got something. And he says to him, "Oh, you look like you've got something. Like, what do you know?" And Ashvajit says, "Oh, he says, look, He says, my teacher's a Buddha, but I'm not sure I can really tell you properly, but I try and tell you the best I can. So Ashwajit tries as best he can to tell Shariputra the Buddha's teaching. And Shariputra understands immediately, and I think becomes a stream entrant on the spot. And then becomes one of the Buddha's main and leading disciples and becomes enlightened. And so even though he, in a sense, has even immediately overtaken Ashwajit in spiritual terms, if you can talk that way, every single night for the rest of his life, he prostrates in the direction of Ashwajit. He finds out where Ashwajit is staying and prostrates in his direction. So I think that's what I mean by you're measuring something in a different way than our usual measurements, yeah? So it's that kind of gratitude, but at the same time, it's a living thing. It's one, something gets sparked off from one person to the other. It's something that's alive, and it's something that's mutual. And again, I think somebody, I can't remember who it was, and I touched on this, and we really, really emphasise this, entry around that here at this centre, that this, even though we're talking about respect for wise opinion and being open to the influence of people wiser than ourselves, there's a two-wayness to this. There's a two-wayness in several ways. So one, maybe I'll give you just an example of something I was involved with just yesterday as it happened. I was involved in what we call a Kalyana Mitra ceremony. So Kalyana Mitra means spiritual friend, but it means particular spiritual friend with this vertical dimension. And we have in our tradition the possibility of that kind of relationship being formalised in a ceremony where one person takes, as it were, two Kalyana Mitras, so two people that they look up to as more experienced than herself, and in a simple ritual, sort of ritualise that connection. So I had the pleasure of conducting one of these ceremonies yesterday, so just the four of us, person taking the Kalyana Mitras, the two Kalyana Mitras, and they're all friends of mine. So I could see that, it was a very, very joyful occasion, and you could see how much it meant to this person who, with both sincerity and intelligence, was taking these Kalyana Mitras, people that she thought could help her in her spiritual journey. But I know for a fact, because the other two are friends of mine as well, that this was really very, very deeply affecting them, the fact that they were being entrusted with this in this way. So I know one of them who's a particular friend, she said that even before the ceremony, as soon as she was asked to be someone's Kalyana Mitra, it immediately had a very, very tangible effect on her. She was going on solitary retreat, and she thought, oh, just take a novel or two, just in case I get fed up meditating, I'll just take a novel or two to distract myself. And then she thought, oh no, but I'm going to be somebody's Kalyana Mitra. This person probably wouldn't do that, so how can I do that? And so she left her novel behind, and she said, oh, I was really glad I did, she said, because it did get a bit tough at times, but that was when it went deeper, and if I'd had that novel, I would have just, you know what it's like, you know? So that was quite interesting, very tangible of her. She wanted to live up to this, and yes, it was affecting, it was mutual in that sense, but it's also mutual in the sense that these relationships are completely fluid. It's not a fixed hierarchy. It's because it's a natural hierarchy, for want of a better word. It could at some point in the future, or even with different aspects, change around. So, the person who's taking on these Kalyana Mitras, there'll be some areas of life she's more experienced in, and she's the wiser one. Down the line, in terms of spiritual development, who knows, anything can happen. So it's fluid in that sense. And this is so important, actually. It's so important. It's such an important principle of our movement. And it's such an important principle here at the Buddhist Centre that we're talking about things like respect for wise opinion and Kalyana Mitrata, but there's nothing fixed about it, and there's nothing set about it, and this is vital, really, because if there was, it would kill it in a way. We're trying to create an atmosphere. We're deliberately trying to create an atmosphere of that mutuality and that fluidity, and we're trying to create a culture where it's the exact opposite of a sort of culture of exchange. You know, so some of us might happen to be up at the front, kind of teaching, for want of a better word, but you know, I don't know, it's just so, it's not an exchange, it's not that I'm kind of doing it in order to sort of receive anything, or it's not that, I don't know, what am I trying to say? It's not like a night class, that's what I'm trying to say. It's not like I'm a teacher in a role and like you're my students and there's this barrier and etiquette between us and I'm not going to cross this boundary and not allow you to cross that boundary. And I would like to scrap the word boundaries altogether in a sense. It's something much, much more alive and fluid and movable. And it's got to be, I think it's got to be, or else it's dead. It's got an essential quality of relationship to it. And that relationship includes the Buddha as well, so it kind of goes back to the Buddha, as it were, and includes the Buddha. There's so many things I want to talk to you about, and there's so little time. I haven't even let you say anything. Maybe I'll stop talking. Maybe since there are only 7 minutes left, and I'm not going to say everything, I think I've said the main things. And the main thing was I wanted to draw out that tension and say that this can be a creative tension. But maybe, let's see if there's any... is there any actual questions? So maybe not comments so much as I will run out of time. Is there any actual questions on what I've said? Yes?
You mentioned something about intuitive intelligence.
Yes.
Can you explain a bit more how is that different from
inquiry?
Or?
Well, it's probably... Yes, I did say intuitive intelligence, didn't I? I think the main thing, maybe not to overemphasise that word intuitive, but more to see that it's not... Inquiry could also come under it, but it's not just simple intellect. It's actually intelligence based on experience and reason, and something else. Maybe the intuition is that when you do that, maybe come to a Buddhist centre, and many people say something like, "Oh, I just sensed that this was the truth." So there's an intuition in there, but it's based on reason. It's intuitive because we haven't yet had time to test it out. But we will test it out. But we're allowing ourselves to have that response. We're not coming into quickly with a rational that goes, oh, don't be silly, or no, but I've got nothing to do with religion or something. So we're trying to watch out for the kind of maybe the overdeveloped kind of intellect that can quickly turn into something like cynicism. So it's given that intuition a bit of space. We've got to use our intellect and intelligence as well, but not coming in too quick. Yeah, so something like that. Good with that. It gives a flavour, yeah. Yes?
It's been my experience, but I'm sure it's not just my experience, but watching us speak. So, to put it simply, I think it's quite easy to get the wrong end of the stick, or to even take a teaching in the wrong way, and
yeah.
Really get the wrong idea.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a real problem. To that end, my journey took me for a time into Tibetan Buddhism, and my recollection of what I learned from that is that they had a teaching that said something like, if you're going to take on a new teaching,
then you've got to take it on provisionally and then to meditate on it. And then if it works for you over a bit of time, then go for it. That's fine. I hope I'm getting that right, but I'm just interested because that was an important thing for me at a certain point. You see, there's a sort of way to try and navigate this stuff. And I'm very interested in you know, in how you respond to that, and indeed how maybe how the movement's got, you know, got a sort of response to that.
Well, I think that's a good way to put it. You've got to take it on provisionally enough to give it a go. You know, so for example, we're always talking about like going on retreat. So before you've ever been on retreat, you're going to have to sort of believe us in a way enough to get yourself there. But then you're going to have to test it out. So, which I think is what you said. And I really like that word you said about navigate, because I think that's what we're doing. Another way of putting it, and maybe I'll finish here, is what we're trying to navigate the waters is what Bhante has called between the extremes of kind of individualism and conformity. Yeah. So, and what you've got kind of over and above these two is what he's called the true individual. So you've got this idea of the true individual who's someone who would be both sincere and intelligent and responsive and able to be receptive to teachers without being gullible. You've got the kind of opposite of that, which is somebody who's just kind of gullible or somebody who's just cynical. But you've got kind of what Bantu's called the individualist, which is a bit more tricky because that can sort of mask, you can think you're being a true individual when you're just being an individualist, which is just kind of being a bit selfish basically, or being a bit, oh, I'll do it my way, but I'll tell myself I've been a true individual. So again, you could use this word navigation. You're trying to navigate between, probably at least at the beginning of our Dharma lives, we'll be sort of ricocheting between this tendency to conform, tendency to rebel or be an individualist, but what we're trying to find is something over and above that can be both receptive to teachers but can think for yourself, you know. So, and that's where the intelligence comes in, and that's where, and where the intentionality comes in, because that's another way of putting it, that you're sort of deliberately receptive. You're receptive with a consciousness there that this is something that you're active. It's like a bit like when I was saying when Bhante says that to me about this thing about doing the book tour. Like I'm saying, okay, I'm being receptive to Bhante as my teacher, but I'm doing this consciously as well. So there's my own consciousness in there. I'm not just kind of thinking, oh, I better do it in case he's cross with me or something. But neither am I going, no, I'm not doing it, I don't want to do it. I'm trying to understand, well, I wonder why he would ask such a thing. Oh gosh, actually, I think I see now a bit more. So it's something like that. I think we're going to have to leave it. So kind of, yeah, I think it's a rich area, but I'm glad that over the 2 weeks we've opened it up. And then for the next 2 weeks we've got receptivity to reality. So I hope to see you over the next 2 weeks. Thank you.